Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Today, the media eye of the nation is focused on Atlanta, where a defendant in a rape case grabbed a sheriff deputy's gun and opened deadly fire in a county courtroom. Brian Nichols killed the judge plus two others and wounded a fourth before escaping in a hijacked car. As the manhunt continues tonight, the questions are growing, because it's not just this horrific case. Last week, a federal judge came home in Chicago to find her husband and mother murdered, execution style. And just under the radar, there is a surging problem in violent witness and victim intimidation. What's going on? Tonight on Point, the growing and unsettling incidents of violence in America's legal system. We begin tonight in Atlanta, where state law enforcement has joined city police in the search for Brian Nichols. Nichols was the rape case defendant who shot four people at the Fulton County Courthouse this morning, including Superior Court Judge Roland Barnes. Joining me now from Atlanta is Cameron McWhirter with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He's been following developments in the killings and manhunt through the day. Cameron, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thanks, Tom, for having me on.
So first, what's the latest? Mr. Nichols is still at large, and how widespread is the dragnet looking for him?
Well, the entire state is on alert, and throughout the day we've been barraged with alleged or rumored sightings. Police have spent a great deal of time in Jonesboro, which is a city south of Atlanta, where his family has lived, and one of his last known addresses. They have come up with nothing. All of these rumors have tracked down that they've been trying to track down have come up with nothing.
Cameron, was there any sign that this was coming?
The lead prosecutor in the case spoke today and said that he had become increasingly difficult. This was a retrial of his rape case. His first trial had ended in a hung jury. He was being retried, and he had spoken to her actually yesterday, the defendant, and had said, "You're doing a better job this time." He apparently was increasingly worried about being convicted, which would, considering that it was rape and various other violent felonies, he was looking at life in prison.
We read Gail Abramson, the lead prosecutor, saying, "I think he was seeking revenge on the criminal justice system."
We have reports that he, the first person he went after was the judge, Roland Barnes, and that he had broken into the chambers with once he had obtained a gun and was asking, "Where's the judge? Where's the judge?" He then went on to burst into the courtroom and open fire.
Cameron, let me ask you about that. He overpowered a sheriff's deputy, the woman who was escorting, one of the people who was escorting him in toward the courtroom. Was it a choice to go into the courtroom? He deliberately went on in to find the judge? Is that how it appears?
Yes. He was actually in another, he was on the same floor, but he was in another section in a holding room. He was with one deputy who, he is a former college linebacker. He's about 210 pounds, about 6'1". The woman he overpowered was a grandmother who was about 5 feet tall.
Wow. But it was a choice on his part, not to flee the building, but to go to the courtroom apparently to find and kill the judge.
He took the gun. There's some question as to exactly how he got the gun. Then he, which was a Glock handgun, then took off down the hall to the courtroom and actually went into the chambers, which is right adjacent.
And what happened once he was in the courtroom? Do you know?
Well, he shot the judge first, killed him, and then shot the court stenographer, the court reporter there.
Was there no effort to shoot back, to overpower him? What about the security in the courtroom?
We're trying to sort out all the confusion there, but there was one deputy in the courtroom. He apparently captured the people who were in the chambers, held them hostage. One of them hit a panic button under a desk, alerting the deputy to come into the room. The deputy came into the room not expecting to find a person with a gun and was overpowered. So at that point, he had two guns and nobody stopping him.
Is there any word on any exchange in the courtroom between Brian Nichols and Judge Barnes before the shooting?
We have gathered nothing yet as to what was said or not said.
And how,
whatever it was extremely brief because he opened fire and this all... This entire mayhem took place in the span of about 15 minutes.
How did he actually get away from a courthouse that must have had lots of police around?
That's another very good question, one that everybody's asking down here. But he bolted down a stairwell, ran out an emergency exit. There he crossed the street, went into a parking garage, encountered another deputy who had a gun. But apparently didn't use it. He shot that person, killed him, and then stole a car and drove off.
Judge Barnes was 64 years old, Superior Court judge. What was his reputation in the court?
Very, 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 very good. He had a very good reputation. Many of the defense attorneys are telling our reporters today that they would that if you were going to shoot a judge in the courthouse, that would be the last judge you'd shoot. That he was a very fair judge, and he was one you'd want to get if you were a defendant.
But tonight he lies dead, and the defendant is, whereabouts unknown. Cameron McWhirter, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Cameron McWhirter is with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He joined me from Atlanta. We're talking tonight about the rising tide of violence around America's judicial system. A judge dead, a judge's family murdered, and lots of serious witness and victim intimidation. You can join the conversation tonight. How do you read the shocking violence around Judge Lefkow in Chicago, Judge Barnes in Atlanta? Is it random? Is there a reason? And what about witness and victim intimidation? Have you followed how widespread these have become? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York City is David Kennedy, director of the Center for Crime Prevention and Control at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He is a criminologist and has followed the rise in witness and victim intimidation over the past few years. David Kennedy, thank you for being with us tonight.
Good evening.
And with us from Cincinnati, Ohio, is Tom Shuck. He's a partner in the litigation department of Taft, Stettinus, and Hollister, and is president of the Federal Bar Association, which represents the interests of lawyers who work for the federal government, practice federal law, and are federal judges. On Wednesday, he sent letters to President Bush, the Attorney General, and members of Congress, asking them to assure funding for adequate security for judicial personnel. Tom Shuck, thanks for joining us tonight.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Also this evening, from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you here.
Hi, Tom, and hello to our guests.
Tom Shuck, first to you, if I may. Just this week, you've been asking for funds for the security of federal judges. What is the state of security?
I am looking, as we speak, at a 2004 report done by the United States Marshals Service on this very issue. The United States Marshals Service was established by the Judiciary Act of 1789, which established our lower federal courts. And the marshals have been the instrumentalities of the court, not only for security, but for carrying out their orders, since there have been federal courts in this country.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at the summary of that report, and one of the subtitles states that the United States Marshals Service lacks adequate standards for determining appropriate protective measures. In other words, we are dealing with a threat that is new to our society historically in this country. One of the hallmarks of our justice system has been the civility of the process, even in criminal matters, and the public nature of our process. And post 9/11, I'm afraid that many of the rules of our society have changed. Unfortunately, these recent incidents suggest to us at the Federal Bar Association that judges, be they federal or state judges, are not exempted from those societal changes, and the rest of the government is going to have to respond accordingly.
We read Supreme Court Chief Justice William Rehnquist calling in January, talking about a funding crisis within the judiciary as a whole. In spite of that, Tom Shuck, are you shocked by what happened in Chicago last week, by what happened in Atlanta today?
I am shocked in particular by what happened in Chicago, because there have been incidents in courtrooms before, and those are largely a function of the adequacy of local security measures. But to carry this dispute to the family of a judicial officer, and I say that because it might be more than a judge potentially, is to suggest that the United States might eventually have to deal with the sorts of things that certain South American countries or countries in Europe have dealt with for quite a long time. And that's a scary thought, So, yes, that is shocking. What happened in Atlanta is tragic, but I suggest that that's more of a local issue. What happened in Chicago is an issue of magnitude that we really haven't explored before.
We read here that federal judges don't even necessarily have home alarm security systems. I'm reading Judge Roth saying it's time for the federal government to step up and supply those. David Kennedy, let me turn to you for a moment. You've been looking at a wider circle of violence around the American legal system, the often quite violent intimidation of witnesses and victims. It's not just judges who have been having trouble.
No, I mean, this is an old story at a much less visible level, and it's not recent at all. So if you talk to people in poor communities who've had to deal with violent offenders in the community going back not just post 9/11, but going back generations, they have always had inadequate protection. They have had to live with people who are dangerous, who have victimized them, who are not adequately controlled by the authorities, so that if the victims reach out to the police, nothing much happens. Typically, the offenders remain in the community and everybody is on their own.
It's gone on for a long time, and yet we read of a growing national problem of witness intimidation here. In Baltimore, Judge John M. Glynn saying recently, witness intimidation has become so pervasive that it is ruining the public's faith in the criminal justice system to protect them. That's strong language.
Yeah, I don't think it's significantly worse. I think we are finally noticing it. And if you talk to women who live with domestic abusers, they deal day in and day out with this issue.
They know all about victim intimidation. Jack Beatty, stand by. Tom Shuck, David Kennedy, we have to take a short break. We're talking about the rising tide of violence around America's legal system. You can join us tonight. How do you read the shocking violence around Judge Lefkow in Chicago and Judge Barnes in Atlanta? What's going on here? 1-800-423-8255 is the number. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about violence approaching the bench, about the rising tide of violence around America's legal system. You can join the conversation tonight. Are you stunned at these killings or surprised they haven't happened before? And what about witness and victim intimidation? Have you followed how widespread those are in the United States? Have you experienced them firsthand? What is bringing this tide of violence to the courtroom door, even inside the courtroom, inside a judge's home? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joined tonight from New York City by David Kennedy, director of the Center for Crime Prevention and Control at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, and from Cincinnati by Tom Shuck, president of the Federal Bar Association. On Point News analyst Jack Beatty is with us as well. Jack, two very head-turning incidents with Judge Lefkow and Judge Barnes. Tom Shuck looks out across society and says, something's changed.
Well, perhaps something has changed. There are people out there who feel they have nothing to lose, who act that way. And there is a sort of, orgy of violence every time you turn on the television. I mean, in the news, we see that terrorism is a tactic used pretty much everywhere now. And these things are kind of like terrorism. It's just, I'm going to get my way one way or another. I'm going to intimidate the jury, the witness, make the judge worry about his family. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of, we're in a world here where minorities, even tiny minorities, 19 men, brought this country to a standstill on September 11th and have thrown us into a whole new an occupation and war and spend billions. So tiny numbers of people can have tremendous effects, it seems to me, when they act the way these desperate, wretched characters have.
Tom Shuck, what do you think? Videotaped beheadings in Iraq and the world is one big media network now. Are people watching? Are they looking for personal leverage within the system via the gun?
I think people are looking to make a statement, and unfortunately, the statements that have been made this week are terminal statements, and I think our government at every level needs to take them as such. The people who perform judicial service in this country are entitled to do that service knowing that when they go home at night, they will go home to a family who is healthy and well. And in that sense, I think the assault is an assault upon an entire system, not upon individuals. I'm sure that the statements that were made this week are not meant to be other than individual acts. But I don't believe that our system can tolerate a string of these individual acts. I think that our government, state, federal, local, needs to react systemically. I agreed with David that we have an escalating pattern of behavior which is intended to intimidate the entire system, and that the system, as it did following Oklahoma City,
mm-hmm.
and as it did following 9/11, must react, and it must react with a view to preserving the fundamental values in which this system believes and which differentiate it from other systems, and that is that our trials are public in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Justice is done publicly by a person whom you can see. They don't wear a mask. They're not behind a screen.
Mm.
People are dealt with dignity as individuals. I understand that the man who is accused of what occurred in Atlanta was able to do it because he was escorted into the courtroom without shackles or handcuffs, because there was a concern to protect his individual rights until he was retried for
mm-hmm.
what he had been tried for once.
Mm-hmm.
Those are fundamental principles, and they must be kept in mind.
So here in Judge Lefkow's case, we have an out-of-work electrician described as delusional, had a decade-long legal crusade against doctors and lawyers and the government. He was disfigured by a cancerous jaw. He was facing eviction. He left a suicide note in the van, of course, where he'd been living in this van. He confessed to the killings of Judge Lefkow's husband and mother and said he had planned to assassinate her in her home, but that he, quote, had no choice but to shoot her loved ones when they discovered him hiding in the basement. How do you protect against something like that, Tom Shuck?
The way that it's currently dealt with is that the staff of the court, and that includes the judges, when they read these pleadings, they filter them, especially the judges who have years of experience. Those that have some semblance of sincerity are referred to the Marshal Service. I am told that the Marshal Service will contact these individuals, make their own assessment. If there is criminal conduct, as there recently was in an incident in Cincinnati following the murder of the Lefkow family, a local individual apparently sent a letter to one of our judges here enclosing photographs of those unfortunate people. They responded promptly. The marshals went out. The person was arrested. The person was arraigned. The person is in federal custody awaiting psychiatric examination. That's how you deal with these situations on a one-by-one basis, and the initial screening lies with the staff of the courts. Outside of the courtroom, it's a different issue. That's going to be a matter for the executive branch, the Justice Department. Congress is going to have to step in as to determine whether funding is adequate. I think the big issue is not what occurs in the courtroom, but what occurs outside of the courtroom.
Though the courtroom's important, too. As you say, we've always had a kind of civility in the American, or in general, in the American legal system. In any number of other countries, when you see pictures of the trial, there's the screen, even masks, and defendants in cages, even in some European countries, Tom Shuck.
Yes, that's correct. And the significance of our system is that people are presumed innocent until proven guilty, that they are treated with dignity at every step of the process, and it is important to bear in mind that the man who claims to have killed the Lefkow family unassisted, and I submit to you these are matters which are still under investigation,
mm-hmm.
was not a criminal defendant. He was a civil litigant in an action involving financing related to a medical malpractice claim.
Right.
Now, and the initial suspect in the matter, as I understand it, was not a criminal litigant, but his group was originally a litigant in a copyright dispute over who could use whatever name that group would use.
The white supremacists. And, of course, when that trial was going on, Judge Lefkow was given off-site security, but it wasn't considered necessary. Now, David Kennedy, on the witness intimidation side, we've read very recently about in Boston, witness to a shooting by a member of a street gang, finding copies of his own grand jury testimony taped to all the doors in the housing project where he lived. In Baltimore, a 17-year-old who witnessed a grand murder and had agreed to testify, shot in the back of the head a few days after a prosecutor read his name out in the courtroom. And in both these cities, CDs and DVDs entitled Stop Snitching being distributed, naming people that gangs suspect of being witnesses against them, warning that those who cooperate with police will be killed. This is scary stuff.
It's terribly scary stuff. I think we're confusing two very different things here. The attacks on the bench are perfectly horrible and very unusual. This is not the kind of systematic intimidation of the bench that we've seen, for instance, with narco-terrorists in Latin America, in which a criminal class has very deliberately and very purposefully put pressure on the judiciary and has been very successful in doing that. These events are not like that. They are much more like a domestic murder-suicide or a spree shooting by a fired employee. We have in social science a technical term for those people. We call them wingnuts. And I don't think there's any reason to think that we're looking at anything systematic, anything that will be sustained outside, I'm afraid, of a fairly inevitable wave of copycat incidents that the coverage of these sorts of events is almost bound to produce.
Well, I mean, that's a sanguine analysis, but if you lose that sort of faith in civility, if you lose, starting with victims and witnesses, part of the legal system, if you lose a sense of the sanctity of the process, why doesn't it just extend on into the courtroom?
The civility has existed in the courthouse. It has not been very much in evidence outside it. And I'm very much afraid that what we're going to do is the same sort of thing we usually do when this kind of risk reaches well-off white folks, mm-hmm. which is to devote an enormous amount of energy to protecting people who are already very safe and who will, for the most part, remain very safe. What's been going on out in the community is anything but civil. And what has been true for a very long time and which does seem recently to have gotten somewhat worse is that in really troubled communities, in people essentially locked into what are supposed to be safe private relationships and are anything but, the intimidation of witnesses has been pervasive. It's been severe. It's in especially markets or neighborhoods affected by drug markets and mm-hmm. gang violence mm-hmm. and things like that become normal. And everybody involved in that work knows it. The offenders know they can get away with it. The victims know they can get away with it. The cops know what's going on.
And justice it must be awfully hard to get
to
done.
Cooperate with them. Mm-hmm. And there is nothing new about this.
Tom Shuck, I know I have to lose you in a moment, but let me just ask you. Witness intimidation, as David Kennedy says, obviously has a much longer, more pervasive history, but it seems to be on an uptick. Do you see the violence against judges, the violence against witnesses and victims is entirely separate streams or related in that kind of cultural turn you described earlier?
Oh, I think they're clearly related. I suggest that with respect to David, this is not a class-based issue. This is an issue of, ultimately, are you going to want to be a federal or a state court judge if it means maybe going home to a bunch of dead people? Now,
I'd suggest
it is not about whether you can afford security. It is about whether our process is going to work. And if our process is going to work, the instrumentalities of government must come to the aid of those who perform its most fundamental functions. I don't disagree that there are many problems. We've had a case in Cincinnati within the last month where they had a felony, double murder, and they had to arrest the witnesses in order to get them to come to trial to testify.
Because they were too scared to come otherwise.
And certainly, different communities with different social values in our country have different pressures obtaining to them. But it is one system, and the one system throughout the history of this country has been the system that deals with all of these issues, regardless of your wealth, regardless of your color, regardless of your social background. And it would be a tragedy if that were to change, in my opinion.
Tom Shuck, we thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Tom Shuck is president of the Federal Bar Association. I want to welcome into our conversation now from Baltimore, Patricia Jessamy. She's state's attorney for Baltimore City. She's supporting a bill that would reclassify witness intimidation as a felony instead of a misdemeanor. It would also raise the maximum punishment to 20 years in prison from the current 5 years. Patricia Jessamy, thanks for being with us tonight.
Good evening. How are you doing?
Well, we're all right, but we don't like exactly what we see out there tonight. You in Baltimore recently had the case of Ricky Prince shot in the back of the head when he was supposed to testify in a gang murder trial. How serious is the problem of witness intimidation in your city, Patricia?
The problem in Baltimore is extremely serious. In our non-fatal shooting cases, we end up having to dismiss about 25% of those because the witnesses are too afraid to come to court or they've gone underground, hiding themselves out because of fear, threats, and intimidation, or they come to court, they're so scared they recant their prior testimony.
Well, it seems perhaps doable to protect judges, but how do you protect all the potential witnesses in this country, Patricia Jessamy?
Well, there are a lot of things we can do, and on the local level, we're not the U.S. Marshals. We're not the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
We can't change individuals' identities. We can't, you know, cart them off. Sometimes we do move them. We relocate them across town, across the state, and sometimes even across the country. We can't provide 24-hour protection, but there are a lot of things that local jurisdictions can do to heighten the level of security of individuals who want to cooperate with law enforcement.
It sounds like you need those. We want to hear more about that, but I want to begin to bring our callers in. Irene is calling from Winthrop, Massachusetts. Hi, Irene. You're on the air.
Thank you. I wanted to ask any of your callers or commentators to comment. You, Mr. Stahl said it's what's happening outside the courtroom that's important, and you then mentioned a number of things like CDs being distributed to intimidating
potential witnesses. Yes,
I would like to enlighten, especially of a local case, which is the recent Massachusetts case where Judge Ernest Murphy was the subject of.
A libel suit.
He sued the Herald.
That's right. He sued the Boston Herald newspaper. That's right.
Yeah. And the original case was that somebody claimed he made a dismissive comment about a rape victim. Howie Carr's column commented the next day that maybe Judge Murphy would feel differently if his daughters were raped. The very same day, Judge Murphy's home address and telephone number and his daughter's names, ages, and schools were on the Internet. And his family received multiple death threats, and his daughters received multiple rape threats from Internet nuts like the guy in Chicago. So this is hits very close to home. We also had a case in Boston a few years ago where a gang member shot a DA, Paul McAuliffe.
Right.
And nobody thought it could possibly be that because it was this understanding.
Irene, what do you think is going on here as a citizen?
Well, I just would like somebody to comment on the role of the press and the Internet on some of this stuff. Maybe a little more care for the privacy of people who are, I don't know how you can't control it, but to suggest in a newspaper that a judge's teenage daughters be raped would teach him a lesson.
Yeah, that's pretty rough stuff.
Calling every nut case wing nut, as your other commentator said.
Right, saying kind of come and get it. Irene, let us pick that up. Jack Beattie, let me turn to you on that. I mean, Irene asked for some care in the press, but at the same time, as she points out, you've got the Internet there. It is the information age. You can find almost anybody's address and phone number and much more on the web these days, and access is not restricted.
No, as my friend Jamie Gorelick discovered this summer, she was one of the commissioners on the 9/11 commission reporting, and she gave one of the witnesses a hard time, the attorney general tried to make it out that she was the person who had taken away the wall that prevented the government essentially from getting terrorists.
Right.
And she received death threats. Her children received death threats.
This seems to be in the air. And publicity, I think our caller is absolutely right, publicity and public statements are seem to spread it. I mean, the fact that Howie Carr, he's a big radio talk show host nationwide, and here he's printing something like this. And this kind of, pick up, forgive me for seeming political, but pick up Ann Coulter's column. Look at what she says about people.
So the sort of vitriolic quality of discourse, and pretty soon you're talking about almost murder.
Because you've got these wing nuts out there. Absolutely.
Jack Beattie, Patricia Jessamy, David Kennedy, please stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the rising tide of violence around America's legal system. A dead judge, a judge's family executed, and lots of witness and victim intimidation. We're talking about American justice under the gun. You can join the conversation. Are these just flukes? Or are we headed toward judges behind screens, defendants in cages, witnesses arrested to get them into court? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about violence approaching the bench, about American justice under the gun. You've seen the news in the last week or two, and longer than that if you're watching witness intimidation. Question for you, how do we put the dark genie of witness intimidation back in the bottle? And this, does this tide of violence maybe show the limits of handcuffs and incarceration in addressing society's problems? We're at 1-800-423-8255, joined tonight by Patricia Jessamy, state's attorney for Baltimore City, and David Kennedy, director of the Center for Crime Prevention and Control at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Right now joined by James from Winnebago, Wisconsin. Hi, James, you're on the air.
Good evening, thank you. Perhaps I'm a little bit out of my league, but I would just like to express to you that I'm someone who's been picked up for relatively minor infractions, public drunkenness,
all right,
and have served time in jail, and have had times of probation, and I would like to say that I've been in court at other times when I've been able to afford an attorney. This particular time, I had a public defender. And, I mean, there should be no doubt that there's a two-tier legal system going on in this country.
Well, you felt like a second-class citizen?
Oh, of course. There's no question. I was treated horribly. And I want to say that although what happened, of course, with this judge and other judges, this is horrible. But I can understand the sentiment when I'm just a trivial little nowhere person, but
and you were feeling bitter and angry sitting there.
Of course, because I it's a victimless type of crime. The problem is only with myself.
Yep, James, our time is short, but we've got it. It's an interesting vantage. Thank you for raising it, Patricia Jessamy. Let me ask you. I mean, we've seen the rate of incarceration in this country skyrocket in recent decades. Number one in the world. Is some of this, do you think, in part because we're treating society's problems by throwing lots of people in prison?
Well, I don't think that locking people up always solves the problem. So I believe in really three prongs to dealing with crime. The first has to be prevention. Second has to be treatment and early intervention when you talk about juveniles. Mm-hmm. And that third prong is law enforcement. So we have to set priorities in the criminal justice system because there are not enough rooms in the end, so to speak, when we talk about jails and prisons. So there are a lot of things that we need to be doing. But as we are dealing with issues when it comes to violent crime, we must do as law enforcement everything we can to protect witnesses and victims. And we cannot allow the criminals to win through intimidation because what they do is they thwart the entire system of justice when they can get away with murder, attempted murder, and all kinds of other crimes because they silence witnesses through intimidation.
You've got your Judge John M. Glynn, Baltimore City Circuit Court, saying, at this point, saying, we are not much better off than the legal system in Mexico or Colombia or some other sad places, referring to witness intimidation. You've got a 25% rate of not showing up, you say. That's high.
That's right. And, you know, so what I'm trying to do in Maryland is to put a little teeth in our law. We have a 5-year misdemeanor penalty for witness intimidation. It needs to be stronger than that. We also are asking for a provision in there where we can introduce the witness's prior statement if we can prove to the court that the defendant made the witness unavailable.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this is a principle that has been recognized in the law for years and is used by all the federal districts.
But you're saying so, put some more teeth right there. Let me get one more call here. Lana's calling from New London, Wisconsin. Lana, you're on the air.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
This is so timely for me because as an advocate for victims of domestic abuse,
mm-hmm.
I just need to hearken back to what James said. I think I don't have any solutions. Let me start by saying that. But I have seen time and time and time again the justice system's refusal to look.
Hello, Lana, are you there?
The social science and of human behavior and of the cycle of violence. Again.
Lana, your line's breaking up on us, but I think I've got the gist of that. I'm sorry I'm going to have to let you go with that rough line. But David Kennedy, the reference here is to victims of domestic abuse, presumably Lana saying, intimidated from pursuing their own cases when they're victims. David Kennedy, are you there, my friend?
Yes, I am, and she's exactly right. And to that, I would add victims of lots and lots of violent crimes in poorer communities. The idea that the justice system is suddenly in crisis because this kind of problem has reached the bench is really extraordinarily parochial.
We feel you resenting that tonight, and I hear you loud and clear. I mean, Tom Shook pushed back, but you've been watching lots of this at a wide tier for a long time.
This is the oldest of news in most of the populations that actually have to deal with and actually have to rely the most on the protection of criminal justice. Most of the people who need and are processed through criminal justice agencies they're poor, they're people of color, they have very few resources, they have very few assets, they don't have burglar systems, they don't have the U.S. Marshals looking after them. And the reality in many of those neighborhoods and in many of those homes for a very long time has been that this kind of thing is the norm.
So you see two judges get hit, and it's terrible, it's awful, but you say, hey, what about everybody else that got very little attention for a long time?
And I want to congratulate my friend Pat Jessamy, who, as usual, is way out in front on the right issues.
And you know, I think what the prior caller was saying was also that as a society, we're dealing with criminal behavior on the back end and not dealing with all those issues on the front end that we should be dealing with.
Amen.
And that is an issue, too. And as law enforcement people, we have to learn, and David knows because he was working with us to develop a project that dealt with things from the front end as well as the back end.
Patricia Jessamy, State's Attorney for Baltimore. With that, we're out of time, but thank you for joining us tonight.
Oh, you're welcome.
And David Kennedy at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Jack Beatty, there's the word. Deal with it up front, not all in the courts.
Yes, crime prevention, and yet the Bush budget, cutting block grants to cities, cutting money for public housing.
It would be good to deal up front. Jack, we're out of time. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
In a moment, a look back at a violent week in Iraq. This is On Point. It has been a bloody and eventful week in Iraq. Yesterday, a suicide bomb attack on a funeral procession killed at least 47 in Mosul. Tensions deepened between the U.S. and Italy over the facts surrounding the shooting death of an Italian intelligence agent by American soldiers. President Bush has promised a full investigation. And with all the bad news, there was a flicker of hope. Shiite and Kurdish parliamentary blocs have announced a tentative agreement on forming a new government. For a sense of whether things in Iraq are knitting together or coming apart, we turn to Michael Ware, Baghdad bureau chief for Time magazine. I asked him this afternoon how he's making sense of this week in Iraq.
Well, it's certainly been a week where we have seen the war continue apace, while at the same time what's emerging as protracted political negotiations are underway. It's unclear if they're making headway or not towards forming this new Iraqi government. Already the date for its first General Assembly or meeting of its parliament has been postponed. But most shockingly has been the ongoing insurgency and the terrorist campaign here in Iraq, punctuated by two particular sets of incidents, a double bombing, a twin bombing on consecutive days in Mosul, which has killed more than 50 people, as well as the discovery of dozens, literally dozens of beheaded and shot bodies in towns near the Syrian border, most of them being police officers, soldiers, government workers, anyone attached to the coalition. Their identities are still to be fully revealed. So it's been a week where the government remains in limbo, yet to step forward. Everyone is waiting to see what shape it will take, yet at the same time the insurgents are maintaining their pressure, albeit somewhat less than in the high tempo of the campaign that we saw leading into the election by the insurgents. We are still seeing a very vigorous and clearly bloody offensive by the insurgents, applying pressure to both the emerging Iraqi government and to the coalition forces.
Michael, let's look at the violence side of that first. What do these very large numbers of deaths this week and the discovery of mass graves say about the strength and determination of the insurgents? What do they say about U.S. forces and Iraqi security forces, which were waiting to gain in strength?
Well, what we're seeing is the insurgency regenerating itself after its loss of its sanctuary in Fallujah and after the energy and the material and quite simply the human costs for them to launch their offensives during the election here in Iraq on January 30. That was an offensive that failed to stop the election itself, yet I don't think it was ever within the insurgency's capabilities to completely shut down the vote. So what we're now seeing is the insurgency regenerating, coming back together. We're starting to identify different trends in the patterns of their attacks. We're seeing a greater highlight, for example, on the suicide bombings, which now are almost daily again. In fact, it's not uncommon to have many in a day. Yet at the same time, we're seeing lots of maneuvering, particularly by the homegrown Iraqi insurgency, as opposed to the holy warriors who have come from outside of Iraq to fight the U.S. Army here. We're talking about the former Baathists, the former members of the armed forces here in Iraq, the former intelligence officers. These men are now reassessing their positions. Since last summer, we've seen them, these disparate nationalist guerrilla groups, for want of a better term, coming together to strike a political platform. We've now seen the early signs of them seeking out the Americans for negotiation, and a dialogue has begun. That process is continuing now. U.S. government planners here, the military and on the diplomatic side, are seeking to capitalize on this, and as they say, to drive a wedge between the Baathists and the former military officers who are the backbone of the insurgency here, who provide the weight of numbers, away from the foreign jihadi or holy warriors, principally those led by al-Qaeda leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi.
Michael, let me ask you about that. Is it perceived then that there's a real possibility of a dialogue that would lead to a negotiated settlement of the insurgency?
That's certainly the U.S. government's aim here in Iraq. It wants to draw the Sunni insurgency out and somehow bring it into the political process, at the same time nudging or hurting the Iraqi, principally Shia-led government, to the table to talk with the Sunni insurgents. The Sunnis, for their part, I believe, are at this stage open to this suggestion. It's being seriously considered from what we're picking up from the insurgency. We must bear in mind that the insurgency is in two parts here. One is the foreign holy warrior and the hardcore Islamic militants here in Iraq. The other is the Baathists and the remnants of the military. They're fighting for entirely different reasons and for entirely different aims. The Baathists, for example, are pursuing a secular democracy, albeit not the one that currently exists here in Iraq, but that is their aim. Meanwhile, the jihadis are seeking a full Islamic state. That's not something that the Ba'athists want. So it is entirely possible, given the long-standing friction between these two parts of the insurgency, over tactics, over money, over territory, that it is a viable alternative to consider that these men can be negotiated from the battlefield and drawn into the political process.
And this week we've seen the tentative outline of an agreement between Shiite political parties and the Kurds to name a Shiite prime minister, a Kurdish president, based on the transitional law that is not the deeply Islamist law, but Islamic law as a source of legislation rather than being the sole source. Is that a structure that the standoff Sunni forces could plug into, could work with?
Well, theoretically, the answer would be yes, if you take them at their word. Even if you don't, even if you factor in some real politics, there is room for maneuver with such a formula. Now, talking to the insurgents themselves, talking to their leadership, talking to the Sunni community leaders and senior religious figures, what they say is, again, for what it's worth, that they're prepared to accept a secular democracy, even one led by the Shia, or, for argument's sake, a Kurd or a Christian, as they say.
Mm-hmm.
As long as they claim that clearly they are involved and the Sunnis have fair representation, to say the least, but also their main qualifier is that the leader or the government be comprised of what they call real Iraqis. Now, what they're talking about there are these exiled Iraqis who fled during Saddam's regime, took sanctuary in Iran, in Jordan, in Europe, in the United States. The Ba'athists, the Sunnis, believe that these men, to have lived and survived in a foreign country during Saddam's regime, must have made an accord or come to some kind of a compact with their host country. Now that they've returned and they've been elected the leaders of this country, these men they call the exiles, those who came on the back of the tank, the Sunnis believe cannot disavow or divorce themselves from their ties from their former sponsors.
Michael, I have to just ask you briefly as well about the case of the Italian journalist Giuliana Segrena. New information out this week from the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad saying that the American soldiers who fired on the car, where of course her security comrade was killed, that those forces were providing security for John Negroponte, the U.S. ambassador to Iraq. Where is this investigation leading?
It's going to be very interesting to see what the investigation concludes. So far, the facts still remain a little murky, but what did emerge today is that, yes, they were what's called mobile checkpoints on the main road, the highway artery leading to the airport. These are mobile, roving, or temporary checkpoints that set up on roads at irregular times and at irregular points. They were done because that was a night of foul weather. And Ambassador Negroponte was having dinner that evening with General Casey at the airport at General Casey's headquarters. Unable to fly, he took a road convoy. Those checkpoints were there to ensure that that route was clear. And it was those checkpoints, or one of those checkpoints, that the car carrying the Italian intelligence officers and the journalist came upon. And that's what led to the shooting.
For more information coming out there piece by piece, an investigation ongoing. Muckleware, thanks for your insight on this week. We appreciate your being with us. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Michael Ware is Baghdad Bureau Chief for Time Magazine. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.